Morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Thank you very much.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Thank you for inviting us.
No, absolute pleasure. So we've got Julie and Pete here. So if you want to kind of just give us a bit of an introduction to yourselves, and then we can wade in. Yeah. So
first and foremost, we would like to, on behalf of our families and our supporters, wish all the very best to Mr. Tom Wagmer for a speedy recovery. What a gentleman he is. I've only met him once. That was in the pub. Not always drinking on.
On the session, maybe. How do you know?
I don't drink.
Okay.
I saw his van outside the pub. And I think I ran you, didn't I? I said, Julie, I should go here. Like,
yeah.
So I forced my way into the pub. And he was lovely. His bodyguards just let me speak to him. That was so lovely. And I asked him, if when you had the new stadium, can we have a bigger plaque? And he said, yes, absolutely. And I was telling him about mom, because our mum is 92. And he said, your mum's 92. He said, can I speak to her? So I was like, well, yes, yeah. So I rang her and she didn't answer. And then she rang me back and Mr. Wagmer answered the phone. And that completely threw her. She didn't know who he was. So we were trying to be nice. And she said, I'm sorry, I don't know who you are. But he was lovely. Yeah, he was, we wish him a really speedy recovery.
Yeah, for someone to come in from where he's come from, just get the city, understand the people.
Absolutely, and Jeremy Dale as well. He's been fantastic with us. I mean, for this last year's memorial, he had these printed to show that we do 90.
Yeah.
And they just, fantastic.
On the 21st, this last 21st, there was an actual game, Villa and Blues Ladies playing each other. So
you had them made.
Had them made. Both teams wore them in their warm-up and everything. Yeah. And that was really...
I remember seeing it. I remember seeing it. I thought,
It's been fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's been a struggle to get... the football recognition from everybody. But obviously, me being, Blues fan and whatever, I know quite a lot about the history of, from sort of like when I started going, we've been 8 years old, 1968, you know what I mean? But all through the pub bombings, the aftermath of it, and then trying to fight to actually get the Cubs to recognise what's gone on, and been a struggle until the new regime's coming.
And that's part of what they're doing, is they're building a community. So around here, there's jobs for the community. They encourage your kids to come down who are from lesser backgrounds and want to be able to afford to come down to football and community. And this fits hand in hand to what they want to convey, I think, and puts them in a position where it's relevant to Blues fans as well as other fans around the country.
Yes. Yeah. But for viewers that will listen to this who don't know anything about our campaign, my name is Julie Hambleton. My sister was Maxine, and she was killed nearly 52 years ago in the Bone and Pub bombings. On the 21st of November in 1974, it was a Thursday. It was payday, because people were paid on a Thursday back then. And Maxine had arranged to meet some friends from what she just got a job at with Selfridges, because she just returned not long before from France in the Champagne vineyards, where she was stamping on grapes to improve her French for her A-levels. And she was meeting friends in a pub called the Tavern in the Town, so that they could share the photos of her and her other friend who was with her, Jane Davies, who was only 17, and Jane was killed as well. And also to hand out invites, because the following day on the Friday, she was going to have a housewarming party, because she just moved into a house with two of my brothers, Brian and Paul. And my other sister and I were due to go. I was only 11, my sister was 13, but because Maxine was so old for her age, she was only 18, but she was so worldly, Mom trusted her, and we were going to be going. And she had done her own invitation cards to hand out to her friends because they didn't have a phone. Phones were very expensive back then. They're used today. I don't think they know what a telephone and what we know as a landline would like she look like. So she designed these invitations so people knew what bus to get, the address and everything. But two bombs went off. One was in the Morley Bush first. And then a second bomb went off about 8 minutes later in the tavern in the town. And the tavern in the town was in a cellar. It was underground. And there was no way out. Whereas the Morley Bush, there were multiple ways in and out. But in the tavern, there was only one way in and one way out, and that was down the stairs. There was 21 people that were killed in the process of the bombings. And over 200 people were left with a range of injuries. I mean, some of them were so horrendous. And these are the 21 who we fight for who were killed. Now, two of the youngest to be murdered were Neil Tommy Marsh, who was 16, and Paul Anthony Davies, who was 17. This is Paul Anthony Davies, and this is Neil Tommy Marsh's mummy standing at his grave because there are no surviving photos of him. He was only 16, and Paul Anthony Davies was only 17, but they weren't in the pubs. They were walking past the Morley Bush and were killed by flying glass. But it took the police 4 days to go to the relatives and tell them that their boys had been killed. Now, Paul had a son who was born posthumously, so who's also named Paul. His other adopted in is my baby brother. He's a lovely, I love him to bits. And he looks just like his dad. And there was also another lad who was born posthumously because there were two brothers that was killed. And that was Desmond William Riley and Eugene Thomas Riley. Desmond had come to both of them as a surprise because to visit his family because they just found out his wife was pregnant. And their son, they were both killed. And their son was born posthumously as well. So there were two young men in our city that were born who never got to meet their own fathers. In the years that progressed, we realised that justice hadn't been served and would never be served until we get a public inquiry. In 1974, within a day of the bombings, the police arrested six men of Irish descent. To cut a very long story short, these six men were then sentenced to life in prison for the bombings. But the one man, his name was Paddy Hill. He fought for years against the sentencing, saying, "We didn't do it. We didn't plant the bombs. We didn't build the bombs. We didn't do it." And in 1991, they were released on their third appeal. And because the police and the media had done such a good job on them, even today, people still believe that they were guilty, that they did this. But my brother and I, when we started campaigning nearly 20 years ago, we took a huge leap of faith to meet Paddy Hill, which was the hardest thing we'd ever done. It really was that when I walked in the room and he was there, I was inconsolable. I couldn't stop crying because I thought I was being a traitor to my sister and to the other 20 and to our mother because our mom had ID'd the remains of Maxie, what was left of her. But as it happened, it turned out to be the best thing we ever did. Paddy became a staunch supporter of ours. He gave us access to all of his paperwork, all of his documents, which I believe we would still have. He passed away last year, unfortunately. But he was a staunch supporter of ours and backed us wholeheartedly. And when I started to raise my head above the parapet was in 2008. There was an awful lot of things going on. There was something that was, I can't remember what it was, but there was something in the paper about, I think it was about, because the six men who were sentenced to this were known as the Birmingham Six. And I think that there was something in the paper about it. And then I was watching the news and there was all these public inquiries taking place. And I was thinking, well, where's our public inquiry? Why do we not get a public inquiry? If the Birmingham Six didn't do it, then who did? And why is nobody investigating? So I wrote to the, this was in 2009 now, I wrote to the then Chief Constable, Chris Sims of West Midlands Police, asking him what he was going to do. He's a public servant, repay your salary. So what are you doing to look for the real killers of our loved ones? He didn't respond. He had an inspector respond, basically telling me in the letter to go away. He's too busy for the likes of you. That was the tone of the letter. Right. So I wrote back to him and to the Chief Constable, telling them how contemptuous their tone was and that I insist on having a meeting with them. They're a public servant and we want to know what
I'm going away.
Yeah, quite. And they got the desk sergeant to respond then, telling me they're both on holiday. So I wrote to my MP at the time, who was Khalid Mahmood, and Khalid Mahmood wrote to the Chief Constable, and it took the Chief Constable a year to respond to the MP, a year. And do you know how long it took the Chief Constable to eventually write to me? Five years. Because you see, this should be put as the motto for all of the British establishment, when it comes to the Foreign Commonwealth Office, MI5, MI6, West Midlands Police, it should be, ignore them, they will go away. Now, I know that that is the case, to give you a prime example, because people used to say that we're conspiracy theorists. Not very many fabric people ever said that, but that's what's in the back of their minds. And we are not. Everything we have said has come true. I can't remember her name, the lady. But anyway, she was the pensions minister, Altman. Her name is Baroness Altman. She said that some years ago, she was in nothing to do with this. This is to do with pensions. But she was in a meeting talking about the WASPI women, you know, about the WASPI women who lost their pensions. And she said that one of the cabinet members, this was the Conservative party at the time in government, had said to her, referring to the WASPI women, ignore them, they will go away. And that just confirmed everything we'd ever said, because what they do is the 3 D's, and this is across the board for families like us: deny, delay, and death. Deny that you have any information. When they find out that you have information, delay sending you out, and then hope that they die in the meantime whilst they're waiting to get this information. Because the governments have, and the Secret Services have been telling us for years, they have absolutely no documentation whatsoever to do with the Birmingham pub bombings. Now, what your listeners may not be aware of is that the Birmingham pub bombings is the longest unsolved mass murder of the 20th century in England. And nobody is looking for the murderers. West Midlands Police were claiming that they were looking for them. But then the evidence that they gave, and which I think was about 3 or 4 years ago, the CPS kicked it out and said, you haven't got enough evidence. We're constantly in a battle with them. What people need to understand is, going back to 1974, in 1974, at that time, the IRA, the Provisional IRA, who were named as a terrorist organisation, had been bombing Birmingham, planting bombs in Birmingham and around Birmingham, the West Midlands, for the whole of 1974. And I think it was 53 bombs had been planted. and exploded. Most of them are bigger, but didn't harm anybody, fortunately. And the government at the time, which was a Labour government, wanted to dry up their funds. Now, Birmingham has, or had at the time, I think it was the third largest Irish community outside of Ireland in the world. I think it was the third largest after Chicago, I think. And so the government wanted to try and dry up the funds because Birmingham having such a large Irish community, they would go collecting in the pubs. Now, I know this because Paddy told me, even where I used to live, there used to be a pub that Paddy used to go to, and they used to go around collecting. Paddy told us all this himself. And what the government wanted to do was to dry these funds up. They also, at the time, wanted to implement a new piece of legislation called the Prevention of Terrorism Act 1974. And the Home Secretary at the time was Roy Jenkins. Now, Roy Jenkins, by coincidence, was also a Birmingham MP. But as Home Secretary, he didn't want to sign off this piece of legislation because he thought it was too draconian. The Birmingham pub bombings happened. The funding dried up overnight. Even the most staunchest of provisional IRA supporters said, "Not in my name, you've gone too far." And it happened on a Thursday. On the following Monday, Roy Jenkins walked into Parliament and said he was signing off the Terrorism Act of 1974. Our question is, why bomb Birmingham? I mean, why bomb anywhere? Yeah. Why bomb Birmingham with the largest Irish community? It's like scoring a home goal for football terms.
I could take it back from a football point of view. So, like Julie was saying, the bombing campaign and around Birmingham, it was basically they were just doing commercial properties, wasn't it? It wasn't about doing civilians, it was about causing disruption. That was the biggest thing. And there'd been loads of hoaxes and everything. And then it was on the December of 73, we were playing Leeds at home. Now Leeds was on this big great run, they were the best team at the time.
Of course, yeah.
And there was 50,000 people turned up for it, and they locked the gates at 2:15. And there was thousands of people left outside. So about 3:10, the game's kicked off. And there's an announcement comes over the channel. I'll never forget it. It says, we have to inform you that we've had a bomb warning. Bob Hatchard had just called and put us one in. This channel announcement has come out. We have to warn you that we've received a bomb warning. We're going to open the gates, and anyone who wants to leave can. Imagine if there had been a bomb. Obviously, what had happened is someone had phoned up who
couldn't get in.
And more people was coming in. But this was the way. It was a very blasé. People had, there was that many hoaxes going on. Here we go. And it wasn't getting taken seriously. But they were only, these bombs were only aimed at commercial property. That was the big thing.
Yeah. And the other horrendous, I mean, besides the fact that we lost our loved ones and the survivors and the stain of blood that continues to run down the streets of our city, even today, is that the Irish community were vilified vociferously and unnecessarily. Even today, we speak to people of Irish descent who remember their parents being beaten up or being spat on them, And we're horrified to hear that. That wasn't done in our name or in their name. I mean, I can tell you, Maxine would have been mortified. For our mother always taught us, you cannot hate a nation based on a bunch of nutters. And that always stuck with me, that did. And because that's a lot of hate.
It's ever more relevant as well as we've gone through the years, hasn't
it? Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And amazingly, our staunchest supporters are people from Ireland and Northern Ireland on both sides of the Troubles. You know, we belong to another group called the Truth and Justice Movements that has families who have lost loved ones from Bloody Sunday, from Ballymurphy, and Raymond McCord, whose son was beaten to death. I mean, it's just horrendous. It really is horrendous. You can't compare one's loss with another. Our loss is, it's just horrendous. And for a whole nation to be vilified in such a way just because they are of Irish descent or they are Irish, as we got older, we felt ashamed of that because that wasn't done in our name. But at the time, it was ignorance. Obviously, you wouldn't. You know, today we've got so much more information. But and that's what I think the government hates so much. I think that's why they're trying to control so much.
Well, the thing is now, and misinformation as well, is as big an issue as no information. Is it the misinformation that goes out around things that happen nowadays with the internet and social media?
Well, yes, you're right. However, that the issue with us is that we've been told for years that the security services, the British establishment, have absolutely no documentation whatsoever on the biggest loss of life of England's history. I mean, if they really think we're bovine and that we are stupid and that we're going to, because they say these words, they think that everyone's going to believe them. But this isn't just this government. It's successive governments. They've all treated us with contempt and tried to ignore us in the hope that they thought that we'd go away. We are not going away. They are dead. But it's because they're dead that we fight, because we are their voice. Someone has to be their voice. Someone has to fight for them. When we had to fight for our inquest, because to cut a very long story short, a very reputable and a journalist with integrity, his name was Andy Richards. He used to work for the Birmingham Mail. He came up with the idea that, well, surely we can have an inquest because Birmingham 60 will do it. Then who did? And that started a rollerball effect with our legal team, who was NKRW Law, who were based in Belfast, who represented us pro bono for over 12 years. And we started to push for an inquest. West Midlands Police found out about this, and the same chief constable decided to take us to court to stop us from getting an inquest, just an inquest. They didn't want us to have an inquest. And we were fighting against West Midlands Police, the Police Federation, Emergency Services, Foreign and Commonwealth Office, MI5 and MI6 were in court, telling the senior coroner, Mrs. Louise Hunt, that she did not have the authority to give us to reopen our inquest because it never took place in 1974, because as soon as they caught the people who we were told who'd done it, the Birmingham Six, there was no need for an inquest. So it was open and shut on the same day. So, and we wanted it reopened.
So what's the pushback? Again, as a layperson, because our audience, a lot of them will be laypersons to the details. What is the issue from the side of the government and the police with you having an inquest to find out who were the perpetrators?
That was me. We never got to the bottom of. It was almost as if they were scared of what would come out. Cut a long story short, Mrs. Louise Hunt, fortunately, voted in favour and we got the inquest. Now, the thing was, is that when we got the inquest, we had to wait a couple of years.
As you do.
And then the Attorney General decided to hire that he had been the England and Wales's senior coroner for England and Wales, and his name was Peter Thornton, and they flew him in to be the judge on at the inquest. But he then decided that he was going to limit the scope, the methodology of what could be heard in the inquest. So he decided that we weren't allowed to mention any of the Birmingham Six. Now, Paddy Hill wanted to give evidence. His name, not only was he not allowed to give evidence, his name wasn't allowed to be mentioned. None of the Birmingham Six were allowed to be mentioned. You weren't allowed to mention any perpetrators, known or unknown. We weren't allowed to mention any informants or pre-informants. We weren't allowed to mention if there were any pre-warnings. And there was a fourth thing, I can never remember what it is, but there were four things that he had decided to limit the scope on. So we decided to judicially review him. Now, the irony of this is that this very same coroner had 6 months prior written a paper, an academic piece of law, of a paper, saying that a family should never, ever have to judicially review a coroner. And that's exactly what we did. I mean, we didn't know that at the time. We found this out while we were bringing the judicial review. So I applied for legal aid. Again, we've been refused legal aid over 14 times. Now, our mother owns nothing and owes nothing. She's a perfect candidate, and so is one of my brothers, a perfect candidate for legal aid. She's been refused legal aid. So I applied for legal aid because I was still working part-time at that time. And the legal aid agency wrote back to me and said, because we'd started to do some crowdfunding, because we had no choice, I'll explain that in a minute. And the legal aid agency told me that because the crowdfunding was going so well, that we suggest you continue down that path, which means that they are making it a default for people who have paid taxes all their lives into a system that you hope would be there to help you when you need it. We're not giving it to you. You need to go out there and beg for it, which is what we were having to do, going out on the streets and begging with buckets, because that's what we've done here at Birmingham City, at Aston Villa and Millwall and lots of places up in Scotland as well.
I didn't know that was because legal aid said carry on doing that instead of Willis's
yeah,
show.
Yeah,
which,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. But they gave a second reason. Now, this was really significant. They said, we're also not giving you legal. I've still got the letter. And we're not giving you legal aid because we see no merit in your case. Now, legal aid is meant to be impartial. They are meant to be unbiased, sit on the fence. And I was infuriated. I mean, what is the point of having judges then? What's the point in having courts? What's the point in having lawyers if legal aid are going to make a decision that they see no merit in your case? This is what we're up against. So to bring the judicial review, we had to raise £35,000 in 5 weeks. And the football fraternity came through for us in an unbelievable way. There's a chap that's been with us since 2011, and his name is Michael Lutwich. I hate to break this to you. He's a Villa fan. Or he was.
We'll let him off for this particular moment,
But what a guy. What a guy. Without him and without the football fraternity, our campaign wouldn't exist. Seriously, it wouldn't. And we got the £35,000. The judge, the lady judge, I think she's now the Lady Chief Justice now, strangely enough, she found in our favour and said, you know, you're right, he cannot limit the scope. So what did the coroner do? What did, and in between times, he comes a sir. He gets knighted. Anyway, he
what was the name of the judicial review? It's knighted.
He gets knighted through our inquest. When we start the inquest, he gets knighted. Right. Yeah. So anyway, then he decides to appeal this decision.
Right.
So we have to raise another £35,000, but this time it's going to be in London. Now, coroner doesn't have to worry about raising the money because, irony of ironies, he's got a bottomless piece of money of our money that we pay into that he can dip into and appeal. But we have to raise another £35,000 in 6 weeks.
So the legal aid you can't have that you've been paying into this whole time. Now can
exactly, exactly. It's an open door. It's a bottomless piece of our money that they can.
But you can't have it, so you've got to go and raise another £35,000.
Oh, it gets much worse than that. Gets much worse than that. So then, he appeals, and we all have to go to London. We have to take time off work. We have to stay in the hotel. Everything else. We don't just have any judge. No. We have the Lord Chief Justice himself that walks in. He hadn't sat down and we knew we'd lost. You just get to learn. You just get to know. I mean, the Lord Chief Justice ripped into our case. So, I mean, he ripped a strip off him. I mean, I'm deaf in my right ear, so I couldn't capture everything. And it wasn't snapped of a bigger room. But anyway, we lost the case. Now, we could have appealed. But the ballpark figure to appeal that in the Supreme Court would have been anything from £300,000 to £500,000. And I mean, we were tired. I mean, we'd been out begging the streets anyway. And we didn't want to put that on our supporters. That was just too much. So we decided to go with what we had decided. Which one? Oh, no, to go ahead with the inquest. So anyway, the inquest took place, and we're not saying to you about the security services saying that they don't have any documentation. In halfway through the inquest, this witness, his name was Witness O, was giving name. He was naming names as to who he believed was involved. Now, what you've got to remember is the perpetrators were out of scope. But he's... the coroner's KC, his name was Jeremy, I can't remember his surname, but anyway, the coroner had, somebody brought up a question about evidence about who the bombers were and about some other stuff. And so the coroner looked at his KC and he says, "Oh, is this true? Is there evidence?" And his KC looked at him and he said, "Well, sir, yes, there is evidence, but you've ruled it out of scope." So that just proved everything we'd already said, that they've got all this evidence, but he'd ruled it out of scope, but he hadn't. The government had, obviously, because he was being directed by the government. And going back to money, to cut a very, very long story short, I mean, so much came out in the inquest, but it left more questions than answers. It really did. That inquest cost the coroner's solicitors. Oh, and through the inquest, get this, the coroner paid for a PR team to make sure that the narrative was being controlled, paid them over £200,000. To control the narrative.
The coroner.
Right. And his legal team were paid over £3 million. Have a guess how much our legal team was paid. Now, what you've got to remember is that this was on behalf of 10 families. They were paid just over £80,000. So that's £8,000 per family. So this is what we're up against.
So you've got... If evidence wise as well, there's also the thing that...
There's so much to cover.
When the Birmingham Six was released, there was a 70-year embargo put on...
Well done. Yeah. They, in 1991, when they were released, the then Director of Public Prosecutions, her name was Barbara...
Barbara Mills.
Barbara Mills, well done. She placed under embargo all of the paperwork to do with the Birmingham Pub bombings, everything under embargo until 2069. Now, why would they do that? What have they got to hide?
Is that a normal protocol that...
Well, it
is when they've got something to hide. Yeah, in the Second World War, most of it was only under embargo for 50 years.
Yeah.
We did some dirty stuff in the Second World War.
This is why this is so desperate for the public inquiry. The pub public inquiry is the only way that we can
get access to these papers.
That you're aware are there.
Yeah. You know they're there because Paddy Hill told us he's seen some of them. So,
what could be there, in your opinion, then, that is the smoking gun?
Well, you see, we know that the Home Office are implicated in our case. Now, if they deny that, of course they would, but they are implicated. They had known, and if anybody wants to do the research on this, if they're interested, if you look up, I'll try and be as dignified as I can because...
Because we don't get barred from the book.
Because the person I'm going to refer to, I have no time for whatsoever. In fact, none of the bummies do. His name is Chris Mullin. He wrote the book that helped to get the Birmingham Six out. What he did to them, we couldn't criticise. But he did and has chosen to continue to do nothing for us. And he claims to know who the real bombers are. And the police refused to interview him. He was an ex-MP and he became a journalist, or he was a journalist and then became an MP. But he claims to have,
even got such a call.
Protecting your status through journalism and all that.
Yeah, but the covenant, journalistic covenant.
That's it, something like that, yeah. Well, he did an interview, a radio interview on LBC in 1989, I think it was, where he told the... interviewer that he has evidence, and it's even in Hansard, it's in the Hansard on the parliamentary notes, that he has evidence that West Midlands Police and the Home Office knew who the real killers were in 1975.
Why? Let's take a sideways and let's talk about the football. So I'm really interested as well about rivalries and clubs that are rivals, and having done the research, just seeing that the football fraternity were like, okay, let's forget the football. Right. It's bigger than that.
I can say we've just touched on the hoax bomb thing. So the fast forward now to sort of like the 16th of November. We're playing Man City Day there at home. Man City was top of the league. We'd had a bit of a slow start, but we was picking up.
And what year was this? What year was this?
1974.
Saturday
before the book bombings.
Yeah.
And we beat them 4-0. Unbelievable. Howard Kendall scored the first one. Bob Hatton scored two. Kenny Burns scored it. Everyone was all over the moon, sort of thing. Oh, great. Who we got next week? Oh, I've got Tottenham away. Brilliant. Everyone all sorting out to get to Tottenham. Anyway, amongst the crowd, it turns out there was Jimmy Craig was there. He was we spoke about Jimmy before.
Yeah.
And there was Lynn Bennis, 18 years old, Lynn was. And she had a season ticket with her dad, which we can move on to a bit later. But anyway, everyone's all cock-a-hoop and everything, all arranging to go to Tottenham on the Saturday. Obviously the pub bombings happened on the Thursday, but the pub bombings happened on the Thursday, and things went on. We played a game away at Tottenham on the Saturday. Villa played a home game against Portsmouth. Yeah, this is like less than 48 hours since the absolute.
You'd think that
everything.
It's a full stop for a bit.
I was 14 at the time, and we'd gone to school, and we got sent home, like on sort of like say Birmingham way and everything, because everything was all kicking off in the factories and everything, and they said, oh, it's unsafe for kids to be at home. You need to get home quick, because, it was really, really crazy times. But, hey, football goes on, doesn't it? Gone down to Tottenham, there was none of this, oh, we stand together with Birmingham, or everything. There was one of the lads down there. He'd been in the tavern. It's a lad called John McCarthy. He's well known amongst the terrorist fraternity. His name was spotted by the way. It's still, he got bandages in, on him, whatever. He had a big cut to his head. Ed discharged himself, gotten the train down to Tottenham there. Because this was in the days when there weren't segregation as such or whatever. So all the booze of it. And then all the Tottenham lot stopped, don't they? You know, where's your taffin gone and everything?
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. So you can imagine what's happened, like, you know, that everyone who even wasn't...
You know, that's a spike. His bandages were fresh from the injuries.
Side of things.
Like, his injuries were from the...
It all went absolutely ancient. But, you know, it was just the way things were at the time. I got sort of like held a grudge against Tottenham for a long time. You just so like when you get into the justice side of things, you find that there's some Tottenham supporters that some of our staunchest supporters sort of thing. We got this one bloke called Glenn. There's Phil Hickin as well, isn't there? There's Frank.
There's
guys. Absolutely. But you're only seeing things with a football mind, aren't you? Yeah. Now, if you're the Portsmouth, and now there were 17,000 turned up at the crack. I mean, we were the top dogs in flipping Birmingham at the time. Like I say, we was in the first division. They'd come up and they stalled in the second division. Saunders had just gone in, took them over. So they were just starting to build up. So 17,000 was about the normal crowd that they got. But the game was on the telly, and the Villa players and the Portsmouth players wore black armbands, which, you know, okay, fair enough. Blues and Tottenham didn't, so you think, okay, fair enough, you know, perhaps we'll wear them when our next game down here was against Stoke. The return of Jimmy Greenough, he scored 2 goals and we got beat 3-0. No black armbands, and it's something that always hurt me. That it's something that no Birmingham City team has ever done is wear black armbands in remembrance of the victims of the Birmingham pub bombings. I can go on to that a bit later, but yeah. So after that, there was a memorial game was arranged down there. The Lord Mayor of Birmingham at the time was this bloke called Jim Eames. Now, he was sort of like one of these career councillors sort of thing. He'd been made as the mayor. And there was a game held down there between sort of like a West Midlands 11 and an England 11. So sort of like Joe Mercer picked the Midlands 11, the sort of like Blues, Villa, Albion, Wolves. Then we had the Warsaw goalkeeper, Mick Kearns, who was Irish as well. So, and then obviously the England 11. So 25,000 turned up down here. But, there's only some small sort of like cine footage of that game as well. But so that was as much as Blues ever done, had that the memorial game at the ground there. It never wore armbands or anything. That always hurt me, that did sort of thing. I mean, come on.
Was there ever any explanation for it? Was there ever anything officially released from the club or anything to say, acknowledgements of it and, you know?
Not in our programmes or anything. No. You know, and considering we carry the city's second name, I think it was quite abhorrent. But, you know, like I say, thankfully things have moved on and we can, you know, we've got owners who actually care about these things and then think, you know, we're getting progress on that matter. But, yeah, so moving on, like I say, they put the Birmingham Six in. I've got an Irish grandfather anyway sort of thing, like, you know. It was hard at that time to either not have some Irish in you, know someone, go to school with someone, go to work with somebody, you know, everybody, you know that. But everybody turned against the Irish community. They were those vilified they was. And, you know, I'd sort of like kept it quiet. You know, who's it? Shane, looking back, like, you know, you should be proud of where you've come from or whatever. But your name gives it away. And he's like, and he's quite another his name. But yeah, so the Birmingham Six got put in. That was it. Oh, the only argument was oh, they should have hung him. You know, that was the big debate. There was no, you know, question as far as you have it engraved on you. These six faces, and the worst of them was this bloke called Paddy Hill. You had this big scar. You just looked at the face of evil, yeah. This bloke. Like, sorry, Paddy. But he was the
narrative was, this is the villain.
The picture of the six impasses. But it became a bit of a thing then. He said, life for some goes on. The pubs had been rebuilt, and very much as it was with the when they had the pub bombing, no one's going to stop me doing what I want to do. Plus the fact we just want to can say I'm not walking out, like, you know, no one's going to dictate to me. And the Mulberry Bush and the Tavern in the town were rebuilt and became known as the Roundabout and the Yard of Ale. And they became very, very popular. There was none of this sort of, I'm not going in there. My mate got a job as a bar cellarman there. We used to run coaches to away games from there. It's a very popular pub, but because my mate was a bar cellarman there, I used to get the stopovers there. And the gaffer of the Mulberry Bush there, a man called Dave Jones, and he was still the gaffer, you know, years later. But it turns out, when it comes out in the inquests, there was the four of them, wasn't it? There was John Moldens and Michael Beasley. They used to stand up the bar talking away and everything. And Michael Beasley had come into town on the bus, and he'd found this little lucky charm on the bus, and he picked it up on the nights of the pub bombing, and he gave it to Dave Jones, his wife Mary, she survived. He didn't.
Oh,
terrible. But yeah, so moving on a bit, then you got Luddy had got involved. Luddy had heard Julian Bryan
do it. Michael Lutz was the one who came on board straight away. But he's just, gosh, he's
unbelievable.
He's horrible, and he's not a well man either. But without him, I don't think we would ever.
Game changer.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, he heard us on my brother and I on our first radio interview. And because, you see, we've always said that we don't want an apology and we don't want money, because neither of them will bring them back. We don't cast judgments on anybody else who goes looking for recompense or anything like that. It's just, that's not what we want. We want truth and justice and accountability. It's imperative that we do that. But then, as Pete was just saying, Jimmy Craig, he was the last one to die of his injuries. He died, I think it was 19 days later. He tried out for Birmingham City as a footballer. Like, he was an excellent footballer. By all accounts, he was an excellent footballer. He tried out for Birmingham
City. He actually scored a goal here, because they used to have this thing called it was a works league thing, the Sports Argus Cup. And Jimmy used to play for the Wolves. You remember the car factory? And that they won it 2-1, and Jimmy scored the winning goal. Bless him, this all came out in the inquest, And Jimmy had actually gave his medal away to this kid. He became like a bit of a little celebrity. Always played at the Blues. Give the medal to his kid. Yes, this unbelievable bacon.
And then Ling Jane Bennis, she was a season ticket holder with her dad. And after she was killed, her dad never stepped foot in Birmingham City ever again, because he would have been standing next to an empty seat, and he just couldn't find the strength for that.
No, it was too painful to come down. Where do you guys get your strength from?
I can tell you my story about getting involved.
He's a guardian angel. We will forever be in debt to all of our supporters. And Pete, he was firing off emails to Birmingham City with your old owners and that, and with the new ones as well when they first took over. He's took a day off today to be here at work. A lot of the others take time off work to come and stand with us. I'll let you end that in a minute. But while I remember, we also have Glenn that you mentioned, who's a Spurs supporter, and Ian Williams, who is a Leeds supporter. David Taylor, who's a Blues supporter. He's a Blues supporter. They have walked from Birmingham to London with our logo. They took time off work for a week to do the walk, to raise money for us. Brilliant. And to raise our profile. Poor Gok ended up with a dislocated knee. Glenn and Ian lost their toenails. But Ian walked from Preston, where he lives, he's a Leeds supporter, to Birmingham in 2018. Or was that 2019? I lose track. But that was to raise money for us for the judicial review. And then they walked from...
Do you know the crazy thing about that? Ian had done this walk, and we'd met him by the memorial. I can go on to this memorial in a minute. The one that was up at Pigeon Park. And the pub wasn't going to let him in, because we'd all there to greet him coming back. And there's a... I won't mention the name of the pub, like, you know. But they wouldn't let us in. And he'd done all that for the city. And he didn't even come from Fitbit.
He lives in Preston. Yeah. It's just mad. But we have supporters, the Jam Tarts. They've raised money for us. Rangers fans. This one Rangers fan some years ago. I'm sorry if he hears this. Please forgive me. I can't remember his name. But apparently he went in one pub. This is when we were raising money for the judicial review, the first judicial review, not the appeal. And he got an empty pint glass, and he went round to everyone and said, "I want you changing this glass. It's for the Birmingham families in him." We've had Frank up in London and Glenn in London, Phil and so many that they've gone out and raised money for us. At Millwall, there's also Pete and Lisa, they're Blues fans.
Yeah.
They had a shop, and they had our logo put on outside their shop. They've helped us raise thousands of pounds to go towards the judicial review and the appeal. I mean, there are just so many people to say. I mean, so many, but they are the majority of them. Oh, we also have Louis, who is an ex-Valencia official, ex-football player.
Okay.
And... he has helped us raise thousands as well. He built a guitar, an electric guitar, and got Jeff Lynn as of ELO to sign it, because he's a big ELO fan. And he keeps sending me these kits from Valencia to auction off to raise money.
Brilliant.
And then there's Kevin, who has recently just joined from the Distinguished Gentlemen Scooter Club and the East Birmingham Scooter Club lads as well. There's Mark Golding, isn't there? There's Neil Dundee. There are just so many people. There are just so... that there's. I mean, I try and remember everybody. There are just... Oh, and Rachel Seaman. She's a Blue supporter. She comes to everything that she can. And Dave's wife. And also Diggity's Bar, the Blues place...
What had happened, sorry Joy, so Brian was in 2011-12 wasn't it, when Luddy had watched Julian Bryan give this interview and everything, He'd sit there and he'd say, well, you know, this is all wrong. This is hard, you know, there's got to be something that we can do. And Villa played away at Wigan and they'd got this sort of like dust sheet.
Yeah,
just went,
yeah.
Justice for the 21. Took it down. That's sort of putting your flag in the ground, like, you know. And then Luddy had a lot of contacts and he's very persuasive, Luddy. So he's a good way of describing him. He got in contact with you, hadn't he, Julie?
He's very articulate. He's highly intelligent, very articulate.
For someone who showed his passion for football in a certain way, that's the best way of all put it. He's some of his speeches, and he's the sort of person that you would follow. You know what I mean? That's the best way. He got a lot of connections as well. The word got around, and then the Justice for the 21 form, which was, and you know, it was for anybody. But there's something that pulls football fans together. And that's this loyalty, you know. He always said, oh, yeah, he can change it. What? He never changed a football team.
This is true.
Yeah. But, you know, we got different colours on. But deep down, underneath here, we're all the same. We've got a loyalty. And as soon as people hear the Justice for 21, I was one of these people. I was still convinced that the Birmingham Six had done it. And do you know what I was convinced? They'd done a great job, haven't they, the police have, is that they turned round and they said, as soon as I was released, and there you can see this bloke that hated this paddy, I've been locked up for 16 years and everything. There is, you know, calling everybody the traitors. I know that we didn't do it and everything. But then, so your first reaction is, well, who did it? But then the police turn around and say, we are not looking
for anybody else.
So, which to me is, that's police, you know, your brain must try.
Closing that, that's
police talk is saying, well, they're not looking for them because that they've done it and they've got off on a technicality. So that was the mindset of me and many, many other people. And like I say, Luddy and the Justice for 21 form, and they did the hard yards. They'd go and they fronted up flipping Jerry Adams and everything. Who'd come down there, and then you'd got what's her name flipping come over to you, says, what are you like?
Oh, right, what's her name?
Oh.
Diana Abbas.
Diana, you know, what do you, this is,
no, she, no, my brother went over to, this was in London. We went to the Irish Centre in London, in Camden, I think it was. This is years ago now. Because we heard that Jerry Adams was going to be there giving a speech inside. You're like, what the hell? So we drove up and we always do peaceful protests. We never, ever misbehave or leave rubbish or anything like that, because we'd be stamping on their graves if we did that.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be leaving the image of their memories if we were to misbehave.
Everything you do is dignified.
Yeah.
Just keep that hard line.
And there were some people there who had come over from Northern Ireland who wanted to cause trouble. And the Secret Services were there watching us. And, you know, the police came up and asked us, this, we've got it on video, police came up and asked us if we would go and have a word with them, these fellas. So my sister and I went and spoke up, no one loved, like, that these fellas, but I mean, they were anti-IRA. And we said, while we're here, would you please, just out of respect for Alan, would you please behave? Because we don't want trouble. We just want to make our presence. And you know, they did. They didn't kick up. It nearly kicked up at one point, but that's because someone had come out of this meeting and had said something. And so my sister and I stepped in, which we didn't mind, you know, and they were as, credit where credit's due, they were golden. And then who should come out but Diane Abbas? I was like,
oh, no.
You know, there's this bloke in there, this specimen, who has these connections, let's say, whatever your thoughts are. And so my brother went down to speak to her, and I got my video with me at the time, my video camera. And my brother went up and says, you know, can you help us? Please, can you help us? And she looked, her opening line was to him, what do you people want money? That was her opening line. Wasn't, I'm really sorry for your loss. Tell me what would you like me to do? That was her opening line. Well, that put my brother back up right away, and naturally. I just told him to leave her, you know. And the thing was, is that she stayed on the other side of the road so as not to have any contact with us. They treat us like we're lepers. You would think that we had killed them by the way we're treated. But the irony is that if we had, we'd have all the help in the world thrown at us. For as it is, we get no help, we're ignored, we're treated with contempt, we're refused legal aid, and we're told a bunch of lies time and time and time again. Jess Phillips is my mother's MP. My mum is 92. Fortunately, she's still on the ball. And prior to them getting into government, Jess Phillips had always campaigned with us, had said that she will support us, she supports us in our right for a public inquiry, this, that and the other. As soon as they're in government, she became a junior minister. We've heard not back from her. I wrote an open letter that was in our local newspaper in the Birmingham Mail, and I sent her the full letter because the one that was in the Birmingham Mail was 50% reduced, and it was 50% reduced. And she still hasn't had the decency to respond. The only one that has picked up the gauntlet is Liam Byrne, who is Bill Craig. That's Jimmy Craig. That's his brother. Liam Byrne is Bill Craig's MP, and he's taken up the baton to try and push for us to get a public inquiry, which we've been refused. You know, if they can give a public inquiry to everybody else, quite rightly, the Manchester bombing arena, they had the public inquiry within 18 months. You know, Hillsborough had to fight for one over 30 years. We're going into our 52nd year this year, and we are still being denied the truth that our loved ones and our families, the Irish community and our city, deserve. What is it that they are so scared of? They can give public inquiries to everybody else that this government have given a public inquiry to the Finucane family.
Like post office stuff and, as well. Yes. Well, massive, wasn't it?
Well, the Finucane family, Pat Finucane was murdered in his kitchen in front of the children by the British, allegedly by the British state. They've been given a public inquiry. The Omar bombing families, and we know that a lot of the Omar bombing families, particularly Michael, who lost his son, God bless him, what a lovely, lovely man, what a lovely family they are. They quite rightly have a public inquiry. Bala Murphy families quite rightly had a public inquiry. Where is our public inquiry?
So what was decided in October? What was the actual outcome, and what was the reasoning for it?
Well, that's a very good question. That they haven't given us a reason. They haven't given us any reasons. What they're trying to do is they're trying to slot us down into this new thing called the Legacy Commission. Because in 2023, the Conservative government introduced what they called the Legacy Act. Now, the Legacy Act is, to simplify it, it just gives...
They control the narrative.
Any government who's in government, it gives them total control over the narrative. Right. It gives them the legal right to quite literally keep the truth buried forever. Right. And they set up this thing called information collection, reconciliation, something. It's called ICRA, information recovery. Yes, it's called ICRA, ICRIR.
Yeah.
Now, this government, when the Labour government came in, they said that they were going to repeal it. They haven't repealed it. They've just amended it, which has made it worse. But what they're doing, the whole process of it, does not give the victims' families of those that were murdered and survivors anything whatsoever. Now, you see, they're trying to... In the letter that they sent us, they're trying to push us down this legacy commission, this ICRA, to join in, where they claim they claim to be giving us the truth. But that isn't the truth. Because in the same sentence that they're saying, it will give you the truth, they're lying because Stephen Travers, I don't know whether you've heard of Stephen Travers, have you watched the Netflix, the Miami massacre, the Miami Showband massacre? If you haven't watched it, go on to Netflix and watch the Miami Showband massacre. Stephen Travers was part of the Miami Showband band. And he's been fighting for the truth himself because some of his bandmates were shot dead by the British state because they were going to make out that they were terrorists, and they weren't. They were just, they were a mix of Protestants and Catholics who were going over the borders to entertain. He survived. And he had a meeting with the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, Hilary Benn, just last year. And he asked Hilary Benn, well, you're claiming to be giving victims' families the option to join the Legacy Commission to get the truth. But if you're going to give them the truth, are you going to give them access to the public interest immunity orders? Now, for the purpose of your audience, a public interest immunity order is basically a certificate of evidence of state secrets, which is what they're hiding from us. Mm. And Hilary Benn apparently was, he's not here to defend himself, but if he was, he'd probably, he'd have to give the same answer anyway. And he looked at Stephen and he said, absolutely not. We can't give access to the likes of you. Or, I mean, he didn't say like that, but that's what they mean.
Yeah.
To a public interest immunity certificates. And Stephen looked at him and said, well, you're not giving them the truth then, are you? And that's what we're up against. Only a public inquiry will give us access to such documents.
Yeah. How'd you get your head straight with it all, where there's the truth there, but then the build, what is I don't even know how to phrase what I'm trying to say. You know that there's a truth there.
Yes.
But everyone that comes into power then that is dealing with you puts a new layer in the way of, you might do this and this and get a version of the truth rather than
the truth
that's sitting there.
Yes.
So what's the ideal to come from this interview or this, the shining the light back on it now? I know you're doing endless amounts of work about it.
Well, we would like anybody who would like to help us to just...
Yeah, how can we help?
If you're British, you know, or you're part of the United Kingdom, Well, actually, even if you're not, if you feel the need, write to our governments or to your MP to say that you fully support the right for us to have a public inquiry. We're meant to be a democracy. We're meant to be the country that set the cornerstone for justice across the world. As King Charles said in his speech to Donald Trump some months ago, he says that the Magna Carta is mentioned, I think, 17 times in the American Constitution. 17 times. That's our history from 1066 or whatever it was. Where is our justice? Where is the judiciary system for them? Where is this? Where is it for them? They were 21 innocent people who went out one night and never got to see the light of day again. And just two things I'd like to say before we end, if I may, please. Great, actually. Thank you very much for hosting us.
Yeah.
To the likes of Peter, who's taken a day off today to be with us. To all of our supporters across the world, because they are across the world. For everyone who listens to this, thank you. I'm sure... I don't know. I'm sure it's been a bit heavy, but... Thank you.
But it's important, though. It's a part of, especially us as Brummies.
And particularly for the younger generation.
Yes, absolutely. But I would like to say their names before we end. But I'd just like to tell you about Stephen John Wally. Now, Stephen John Wally was an only child. He was on a blind date to see Lynn Joan Bennett, who was the season ticket holder for Birmingham City. Now, Stephen John Wally's dad died the following year after he was killed of a broken heart. Now, that's not far-fetched. You can die of a broken heart. He was their only child. When I spoke to his mother at the inquest, because we had to do pen portraits, that's another matter altogether. But anyway, and I said to her, would you like to do a pen portrait? She says, I can't, Julie. It's just too difficult. She said, it's just too much. She said, when Stephen was killed, she said, and then my husband died a year later. She said, I'm glad they died in the order that they died. And I said, why? She said, well, if my husband had died first and then Stephen was killed, I would have hung myself. And this is the impact of such atrocities on people. I mean, I might sound, I don't know, normal. But the horror, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't think of Maxie. I've got pictures of her all over the house. 20 years ago, you would never seen a picture of her in my house. It was too much. I had to seek counselling because I hit a brick wall and I was very ill. And my doctor said it was a delayed because there was no counselling in 74.
Yeah.
We were sent back to school. We were sent back to school the following week because the headmistress thought it would be the best thing. We didn't go to a funeral because my mom and the headmistress didn't, and my sister wanted to go. So then my sister would go uptown looking for her because we hadn't seen her. Was she dead? The impact is a lifetime. When they put people away for murder and they're put away for 20 years, they only do 10 in this country. It's an abomination, it really is. It's a lifetime sentence for families. It's a lifetime sentence.
We had this thing like, you know, when I eventually got into supporting justice, like I say, they'd done the hard yards. I got told by Pete and Jules, come along, like, you know, you call yourself a brummy, get yourself along. So I did. And it's not until you meet Julie, you meet the relatives, and you look into their eyes, and that pain is there, and you do not, it's something you do not walk away from, I'm telling you, and it's something that we never will. When we go collecting, Chewy has to tell the story. It's like we're shaking the bucket. People say, "Oh, look, I had a lucky escape. My friend, you know, I was going to go into town that night," and that. And Julie has to tell us up. How many hundreds of times has Julie had to tell this story? How many more hundred more times has she had to tell this story? Each time, it's not just sort of like reading off a script. It's bringing up memories. How hard is that? But I'm afraid as a city, Birmingham, we're not the best. The ones that do get behind their families are absolutely golden, absolutely wonderful. But we're very much, it's a shame. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, and need some action.
But the football fraternity, I mean, when it comes to our campaign, that there are people that are best friends now and that used to, you know, try and gouge each other's eyes, hacked metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, probably not as metaphorical. But
they're best of friends. They often say, don't they? Yeah. Who'd have thought we'd ever be? But when it comes to us, it doesn't matter what their politics is, what their religion is, what their rivalry is. It goes out the window because for this, nothing else matters. Mm-hmm. And we can't thank them enough for that.
We're not going to lie, like, you know, there's still the Blues Brother thing is always there. So when we're doing collection, like, you know, I mean, they get double the crowds of us. But we have this thing that we've got to get collected more than one pillaging. So we're lucky that with the, you know, if you start in town, there's quite a few clubs. And then there's some wood, you know, Daniel Duffy, best, God rest his soul, like, from the from the Bull's Head got Holly and Burns, they can't do enough for it. But some of that, but nothing is out of bounds. Some of the lads even go in and collect him in the adult shop there. They do all right, except they threaten to take the picture.
I was going to say, sooner you don't out, the quicker we'll get out of it. Yep.
Yeah. But you know, that's just one small part of it. When we all get together, which we do, and we had this wonderful thing during COVID. Oh, I've got to tell the COVID story. During COVID, obviously it's coming back to the 21st sort of thing. What are we going to do? We arranged to do this thing, the Convoy for Justice. So we'd all do it in cars and do like the outer circle route and end up outside Lloyd House. Now, at the time, you know, the whole world had gone mad, hadn't it? Like, you know, but what a great way and what a fantastic turnout we had.
People have come down from Scotland and from Kent.
Yeah. What? So, yeah. Like, you know...
To join the convoy, doing the number 11 route, it is fantastic.
Oh, the scooter lads had all joined and everyone had all got the flags on the car. It was an absolutely unbelievable sight. Anyway, after it had all gone smoothly, and six people... got letters through the door that they'd broke COVID. Allegedly
breached.
No,
we didn't have it through the door.
Oh.
The police physically handed it over, and I was one of them. I had a chief superintendent knock my door with two police cars. They knocked my door, and I was still in bed. My other half said, "Julia, the police are at the door," and I was thinking. I won't tell you what I'll say.
So all that time you've been after a superintendent, that's how you got onto the door?
She's superintendent, was on the door.
Go on, answer the letters, but...
It was a month after, so it was like, it was just before Christmas, and he said, there's nothing for you to worry about, Julie. And it was the same guy who was on the day at the convoy, because they knew about the police. We've got police permission We've got permission to do the convoy. Anyway, he handed me this. He said, "I'm really sorry, but this has come straight from the top," which means the chief constable. So they were fining me and five others. Now, there were lots of people involved in this because it was outside Lloyd House where we ended. And I got out of the van just to thank everybody. And I spoke for 86 seconds. And that's what they were fining me for getting out of my van and just thanking everybody for being there, because a lot of them couldn't join the convoy. So they just met us to just show their support. And they fined me for speaking for 86 seconds. To cut a very, very long story short, four of us refused to pay the fine. One of them that paid the fine, Tony, he's a landlord at a pub. So he had to pay the fine. And I said, "Look, if you want to pay the fine, there's no judgment here. I'm not paying the fine. I didn't do anything wrong." Anyway, we had this fantastic barrel. You've got to read the stuff that he writes, because he came to the court case. Our barrister, Philip, was fantastic. He ripped the police apart. Even the judge said to the coppers, "Did you see them as an easy hit? Is that why you charged them? You find them as an easy hit?" Because at the time, I was running to be the police and crime commissioner. I'd entered the race for the police and crime commissioner, and they were trying to black label me, blackboard me, to push me out of the race, because they were pushing. Now remember, it was COVID, so all these court cases, murders, rapes were being put on the back burner, but they were pushing for mine to come in March before the vote. But it took place in the September, because one of the four of us who refused to pay it, they was on holiday. Yeah. And I refused, but we took them to court to fight it, and we won. The judge said, "You didn't do anything wrong," because we provided evidence that others had done stuff on a more tighter lockdown. He said, "You didn't do anything wrong."
But he was just crazy, like.
Our barrister, he was fantastic, wasn't he, Philly? He was from Number 5 Chambers. Fantastic.
But out of all the people who were on this convoy, the ones that they happened to pick was Julie, who was running for police and Cronk. It's one of them. You can't beat them, John. What a fantastic campaign that was. We did absolutely brilliant. But you're up against flipping well-run political machines, but we had
over 30,000 people who voted for me.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah.
30,000 people. I mean, the one in Vorian got 350,000. But do you know what I mean? I mean, yeah. I was coming from the starting of nothing.
Yeah.
But it's no surprise that Luddy was pulled in as well.
Yeah, Luddy was pulled in, Kevin
Gormley,
he's a Wembley City Gormley, we're massive supporter, Kevin Gormley. But just to end, thank you again.
That's a pleasure. I feel like we could talk for hours, but we want to kind of get it in now and maybe do a part two, but we've crammed an awful lot in. But
How can we help? How can people help? How can people contribute towards this? What's the official channels?
We have
I'll put some links and stuff up
we'd like people to follow us on Twitter. It's at Justice for the 21. We're Justice number 4, the 21. We also have a Facebook account. It's private, but you can join if people want to follow us. Follow me. I have a Facebook account under my sister's name, Maxine Hamilton. I think we're on Instagram. I don't know. I'm not on Instagram, but I think poor fellow set it. So I can't remember.
No, bro.
But,
get all that stuff. You have to pop them all on the links.
We just need people to support us, to spread the word, really. Spread the word. Please help us. We need, it's for them. For them. The 21 people that have had nothing, have been ignored and been stamped on in their deaths. It's almost as if they're trying to bury them again as best as they can. And their names are Desmond William Riley, Eugene Thomas Riley, John Rowlands, James Frederick Caddick, Trevor George Thrupp, Charles Harper Gray, Jimmy Craig, Maureen Ann Roberts, Pamela Jean Palmer, Jane Davis, Anne Hayes, Maxine Hambleton, Marilyn Paula Nash, Lynn Jane Bennett, Thomas Frederick Chater, Neil Tommy Marsh, Michael William Beasley, Stanley James Bodman, Paul Anthony Davies, Stephen John Wally, and John Clifford Jones. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.